Cosmic Shed.
You're listening to The Cosmic Shed, a show that explores the way science and storytelling collide.
We'll be talking about films, books, music, theatre, TV, and anything else that catches our curiosity. From rigorously accurate science fact to ridiculously speculative science fiction.
We don't want to nitpick, but to celebrate the ways science and art can complement and enrich each other.
Mostly, we just want to talk about nerdy things that make us happy.
We've decided to do all of this from a crumbling garden shed somewhere in suburban Bristol.
The Cosmic Shed.
Science fact.
Science fiction.
And everything in between. Welcome to The Cosmic Shed. I'm Andrew, and with me today is...
Maddie.
And I'm delighted to say that we're joined again by...
Ty.
I'm also delighted to say that we are joined today by...
Anders, a.k.a. Andrew Knight. I work at Bristol Science Centre. My disclaimer is that I have no science background whatsoever. I work in the marketing department, but I just love film.
More importantly, I'm delighted to say... Sorry, Anders, but it's just the way it is. That we are also joined in the shed today by...
Rachel. I do have a background in science. I'm a trying to be a neuroscientist at the University of Bristol.
Today's episode is all about the Disney Pixar film Inside Out. Anders, you've proclaimed to not know anything about science. So talk to us about the film. Why did you want to be in the shed for this film?
I am a huge Pixar fan, and I watched this film twice in 24 hours the first time I saw it.
Wow.
I love Amy Poehler. I think the casting's amazing. It has all the colour and intelligence and heart. I think it stands up alongside some of Pixar's best.
I think they've also got quite a lot of humour in there, like with that that jingle from an advert that they like, oh, we'll just send that back up to the brain just for fun. Yeah, when they're throwing away the stuff that she won't need, like, oh, we can use a few American presidents here. She won't need to know them.
We're also delighted to be joined. Well, not joined, but I did... managed to catch up with Professor
My name is
Bruce
Hood. I'm a professor of developmental psychology at the University of Bristol. I'm very interested in how children develop. I'm interested in the relationship between the brain and the mind. And I've been asked to comment on Inside Out. I was quite impressed with it. And certainly when people were asking me whether I'd seen it, clearly meant that the message had been conveyed or communicated, because they clearly were starting to think about science of development. The notions of, for example, constructed memories, I think that's a very powerful message, because people often misconceive memory as being reliable. And, you know, 30, 40 years of research have confirmed that actually they're incredibly unreliable memories, and they are stories, and they are retold, and every retelling will shape the story. We do know that the self is probably more of a narrative, that there are a multitude of unconscious processes which are going on all the time. The output of those systems can influence behavior. And very often we are retrospectively reinterpreting our behaviors and our decisions to make sense or make a coherent story. We feel we're the ones who are making the choices, but very often those choices have already been made well in advance, or they're based on biases and assumptions that we're not consciously aware of. Where it breaks down, I think where it starts to become a little bit difficult, is the notion of separate emotions. And that actually is a very contentious issue, because actually you cannot see clear evidence for separate emotions in the brain. There are emotional centers which are active, but they're active whether you're happy or sad or whatever. So we've had a real problem with emotion, because it feels as if these are completely distinct states, and the experience is very distinct. But actually, at the neurophysiology level, it turns out they're incredibly much more overlapping and integrated. And so that has led some people to question the whole notion of these actually being separable systems in the way that they're described in the film. So that's probably its major flaw. Yeah. And of course, the other problem with Inside Out is the philosophical problem of the homunculus, the little independent me's all operating independently, because that sets up a real paradox. How can you have little independent me's inside my head and yet have this kind of emergent sense of identity yourself? But for the story to have these competing influences, it makes for a good narrative.
I love Inside Out. It was directed by Pete Docter, who did Up, which I think is, again, one of Pixar's best films. Generally, Pixar films take about 5 or 6 years to put together. These films take so much time that in Pixar credits, there's a section called Production Babies. Yeah. For, like, all the kids that were born during this production, because so much time goes into the script and the planning and the design. And this one was no different. It took almost 6 years to make. And in terms of where Pixar were at that time, it's the first film that didn't from the studio that didn't have any input from Steve Jobs, who was one of the founders of Pixar, and also John Lasseter, who was the head of Pixar, but at this time he was taking over Walt Disney Animation Studios. So there's the brain trust of Pixar that everything goes through, but those two were out at that time. And I think by having John Lasseter out of the picture, it gave Pixar freer rein to do something completely bold. Like the best of the Pixar films, there's something for both kids to enjoy, and then for us adults, it leaves us in a big emotional puddle on the floor pouring one out to Bing Bong.
Did Bing Bong work for you?
Bing Bong completely worked for me.
Okay. Absolutely. Really?
Did Bing Bong not work for you?
Bing Bong not work.
And he was a bit irritating, but yeah, that scene when he jumps off the car. Oh, God.
It's just that aspect of all of our childhoods that we have. It's something that everyone can relate to in terms of having a childhood friend or made-up friend that, yeah, you just hold on to until you reach a certain age, and then it just goes. Yeah.
The film's all about the transition from childhood to adulthood, so the character makes perfect sense to me.
Something that I really loved about the film was the way that the brain, like, it's not like the numbskulls, you know, it's not that you're not kind of fixed, it's so other to the reality. It's like a completely different world. You don't feel like you're in a head, you know, you just feel like it's like it is, you know, you don't feel like you're in your own head. You feel like there's this whole thing going on, and that's reflected really beautifully in the film, I thought.
How much thought has obviously gone into the architecture of the brain in a way that children of all ages and adults can all get something out of it. It's just astonishing, the artistry and the intelligence underlying it all, and then it still comes out. It's an incredibly cerebral film, and then it is something that you can sit with a five-year-old and both of you will have a whale of a time.
The film was made... So Pete Docter, he went to some scientists.
Ducker Keltner and Paul Ekman were two psychologists that were brought in as creative consultants for the film. They told the Pixar team that essentially there are 27 main emotions, and then they just kind of like, well, we can't have 27 main characters. Mm-hmm. So then they boiled it down to 6, and I think up until the last moment there was also going to be surprise. Mm. But I think surprise was deemed to be too close to joy. And so it eventually became the core five of anger, fear, sadness, disgust and joy. It was 4 years to develop like the architecture of like the mind. And on top of that, there were like 7 different versions of the story before they even started producing it. One was like a road trip between joy and fear. And I read that Pete Docter, that was going to be the story. And he presented it to the Pixar Brain Trust. Brain Trust was actually going to be the title of the film. But they decided it just wasn't working. And I think after that initial screening, Pete Docter went home and he was so kind of upset. He kind of realised, oh, Christ, I might get fired. The film's not working on such a fundamental level. Yeah. And he started thinking about everything that he was going to lose from that. And he realised that's where you need sadness to kind of overcome obstacles. Sadness is a crucial part of moving forward in your life. And then came to the realisation that pairing joy and sadness up was the best way to go with the story. And everyone on the team loved that.
He considered his previous successes to have been a fluke. And I love that the man that made Up would consider Up to have been a fluke.
Well, he did.
Wasn't it his and his daughter's experiences? Yeah. He was looking at them as parallels because she was a similar age to the character that Riley would be. And they'd both gone through similar sort of moments of sadness in that passing from childhood to adulthood.
When Pete was younger, he moved to Denmark with his family, and during that time he became very shy and withdrawn, which changed when he left school. But when he moved his family to San Francisco to work with Pixar, he noticed the same thing in his daughter Ellie, and that kind of was the seed of the idea for the film, and started noticing her going kind of through the similar moods and everything that he had kind of gone through when he lived in Denmark. So that was the seed of the story, and then everything came from that, really.
That's one of the things, isn't it, that's particularly different about this film, is that there's a happy ending, but it's about embracing sadness. I don't know if this is true, but it feels like it is to me. The people in this shed now are from various ages, but I think we all have an understanding, I think, that this didn't come to any surprise to us, that, you know, embracing sadness, allowing it to be an emotion that you feel, is beneficial. But I certainly feel like the generation above me that would have been completely alien to so many.
Stiff upper lip and all that, young chap.
Yeah. We only show emotion to dogs and horses.
The character of Riley was going to have a pet at one point. They were going to give her a pet, and there was also toying with the idea of giving them a sibling, well, her a sibling. But then they thought, no, she's got to be more isolated. We've got to show that she is going through this alone, whatever she's going through, all the changes in her life. Her parents are her anchor, but if there's someone else there to ground her, it's not as much of a journey for her to go on emotionally than it is in the film.
From your understanding, Rachel, of neuroscience, how close is this to the reality of our brains? I know there's not five people, but how close is that to what your understanding of the way that our brain works?
We know a lot about disease states, so I think you can infer a lot from that. So, for instance, in things like schizophrenia, you might feel more like you have these things controlling you because you have these uncontrollable sort of outbursts and certain things that you just can't control. So from that, we know that we definitely have somewhere in our brains, there is a centre that is definitely associated with emotions, and that's called the amygdala, which is right in the heart of our brains, or the centre of our brains.
Bruce Hood is a professor of experimental psychology, which is something that I didn't understand as a combination of words. So I asked him what that was.
Seriously, I didn't know anything about psychology when I went to university. I had a kind of layperson's assumption. At the time, I was interested in the paranormal, so I wondered if we could, I could tap into all these unconscious abilities that Uri Geller was going on about. And then I discovered that actually there was no evidence in experimental psychology. There is an area called parapsychology, but I mean, basically, there's no evidence for any of these abilities whatsoever. So that was very quickly curtailed. But then I discovered there's a much more interesting, fascinating, mysterious aspect of what makes us who we are. And there's actually an experimental approach where you can start to try and unpick that. So for me, it was actually a recognition that what we do effortlessly and normally every day is in itself incredible. Psychology, to most people, first of all, sounds like common sense. And it often doesn't have much of a status in this country. It's often associated, when you say you're a psychologist, people think, oh, you're trying to read my mind or you're trying to analyze me. And so there is this assumption that we're kind of clinical psychologists or a Freudian type psychologist, psychoanalysts. And that's one of the reasons I feel that, there's a bit of a reaction against the term psychology and why we distinguish ourselves as being experimental psychologists. Because we differ in the sense that we do real scientific experiments where we measure dependent variables and we manipulate independent variables. And we really do conduct research to try and unravel and uncover fundamentals about the human mind.
Rachel, how is that different to what you're doing?
Experimental psychology is more human-based studies. So I know Bruce Hood does a lot of work with developmental experimental psychology. So he looks at babies and how they develop. Whereas I'm looking at a much smaller aspect of neuroscience. So I'm looking at how the cells in your brain, so they're the building blocks of the brain, how they communicate and talk to one another in order to portray the things that Bruce Hood would study in a bigger model.
Did you kind of have that mindset when you were watching this film? Were you thinking about the science that you do in relation to the film?
Yeah, I was. So in Inside Out, they have things like the memory dump and they have the long-term memory store. And that's kind of where my research fits in, because I look at things like how the neurons, the brain cells, talk to each other, and that is a mechanism for learning and memory. So if you look at the memory dump, that would be where things are forgotten. And when things in the brain are forgotten, the neurons don't talk to each other as much. So I was like, oh, wow, that's a really good way of portraying that to people that don't perhaps have my background in neuroscience, because it's very similar to how it actually works, because Riley would no longer use those memories of when she was in Minnesota. So those are all going into the memory dump because she's not activating those brain cells anymore.
It kind of makes me think about this, that, the function of the brain in terms of emotion, which is kind of key to the film, obviously.
Mm.
But how does that make sense in terms of this physical thing that we've got in our head? Where are these thoughts happening? How are thoughts taking place in a head?
Thoughts are just the connections between neurons. When you think about something, your brain is firing. So the cells in the brain are electrically charged and they communicate to each other via a chemical that's released. So when you think about something, that process is happening all the time. So an emotion is just learning something. So as you pick that up, there'll be a part of your brain that is... We don't know all the parts of the brain that are specialised for different emotions yet, but there will be a section of the brain that perhaps is more attuned to sadness or something. And as you learn that, those neurons that are programmed to understand sadness, they will start to connect more, and those connections will get stronger. And then that's how you would remember that that is sad. And then that's how you would draw upon it if another event that happened that was also triggered the sad emotion. Then it's kind of memory by association. So you learn that certain things are sad, which is why it's so related to how we remember things as well. Like the connection between the neurons is memory, essentially, as we know it. And that is also to do with emotions.
How does that affect people with depression?
The connections between the neurons are altered, basically. So they might have the part of their brain that is tailored towards sad events might be overactive, for instance. So something that should perhaps be a happy emotion is actually releasing a chemical that tells them that it's sad.
And is crying at the end of Terminator 2 completely normal?
No.
The way that's kind of visualised, a lot of that stuff is visualised in the film, I think is incredibly beautiful, with that kind of the coloration of the, let's attach sadness to this memory, let's rework this. Does that make sense kind of to you, the way it looks in the film?
Yeah, I think so, because when you remember an event in the past, you often associate emotions with it, don't you? How you're feeling now will actually affect how you're pulling up things that have happened in the past.
The thing that makes most sense for me in the film, in terms of the narrative of who we are, is these islands. And I have to say that, I know it was bing bong for you guys, but for me, the collapse of the islands was just utterly heartbreaking, and I lost it for about 20 minutes. How close is that to everybody's kind of sense of who they are? Do you kind of pick parts of your life and that defines you?
Because they say that everybody is kind of like the product of their experiences, and I guess that makes sense to an extent, because you will have only experienced certain emotions by having to process different events that have happened in your life.
It's kind of like when you're 11, you know, she defines herself as hockey. You know, that is definitely it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, but then I kind of define myself a bit by astronomy. I mean, it's not me, it's just something that I'm interested in.
Like a facet.
Well, that's what you know, isn't it?
But if you kind of lose one of those islands, as happens in the film, which I guess, you know, this is a transition from childhood, and that's why she's losing these islands. And Bing Bong, your very good friend. As an adult, you don't really lose those unless you have some kind of, you know, mental trauma or disease.
Is it because you have more than those things to define yourself by? Yeah. Obviously, when you're younger, you might be like, oh yeah, I love hockey, or I love this particular sport, and I love this particular hobby. Mm. Whereas when you're older, you kind of have more of a pool of things to choose from. So if you lose one, you've got the rest of them, so your life kind of doesn't really fall apart. You don't feel quite so upset. But maybe if you were to lose several all at once, you feel a bit overwhelmed.
And also when you're younger, the connections that your cells are making are chopping and changing all the time when you're a kid. So as you get more older and perhaps keep some of the things that you like, perhaps astronomy was in your childhood, I don't know, and maybe you kept it as you get older, that kind of becomes more not set in stone, but it becomes more sort of like a permanent pathway that you're keeping going because you're enjoying doing that, so you keep it. But other things that you're perhaps not doing so much, you would lose them because your brain is like constantly kind of rewiring itself.
One of the difficulties I have is like, okay, we can all sit and talk about, we can kind of understand a little bit about our memories and how they work and things, but how on earth do you study children? Because that's what Bruce Hood is doing. He's studying children and the way that their brains are developing. So how does he do that? Well, I asked him.
We study right from the very beginning. And the way that we do it is typically non-invasive, which is nothing involving electrodes in the brain or destroying parts of the brain. You know, we can't really get past the ethics committee on that one. We can look at children and we can devise situations to tease apart what we think are the important things. So, for example, I've got a line of research now looking at sharing behavior, pro-sociality, helping behavior in preschoolers. And the way that we manipulate that is to see what they do spontaneously, and then we can prime them in context, like we can get them to think about other people by talking about their friends, and then see if that changes the way that they help a third person. Looking at the manipulations that we can do to influence what we think is going on. The youngest child I've ever studied was 42 minutes old. So I used to work with newborns. That was my original research. My PhD was studying the control of eye movements. And you might say, that doesn't sound like psychology. But the eye movements are controlled by brain systems, which process the external world. And that is psychological, in a sense. It's the mind processing the external world. So I'm really fascinated by the interface between the developing mind and the developing brain, because the brain doesn't reach adult levels until you're an adult. Yeah. So things are changing at the architectural level, at the implementation level, and this has consequences for the way that you interpret and process the world. So I was particularly interested in eye movements because the newborn baby's brain is fairly immature relative to, you know, a brain of 6-year-old or a 16-year-old. So we're trying to track the relationship between the changing behavior and what we think might be going on underneath in terms of the underlying neurophysiology or brain science. That link is often very tenuous. It means that we can only really study things that we know about, very often based on animal models, because you can't do any invasive kind of work with very young children, obviously. So we tend to be restricted to aspects of perception and sensation, things that you can do comparatively with animals. But the other kind of issues of psychology that people are really interested in, things like guilt or greed or love, or these are high level kind of things that you can't really ever study easily, certainly in children. That's not to say that people aren't doing that in adults. There's imaging studies to attempt to unravel what's going on in the brain's actively doing these high level cognition processes. But even that approach has got lots of problems about drawing the direct link between brain function and mental states.
There's this difference between the mind and the brain. And who am I? Where am I positioned? You know, if somebody suffers a brain trauma, then they lose their sense of self. So that's where the sense of self is.
We operate with multiple versions of ourselves. So we present differently in different scenarios. Part of what goes on in development is children develop a sense of identity and of self. And this fits nicely with some experimental work showing that actually in the absence of that sense of identity or continuity, people are not very good at remembering things. If you ask adults what's the earliest memory you have, very few of them can remember anything before their second or third birthday. You might say, oh, well, they've forgotten. But you ask a 4-year-old or a 5-year-old, do you remember anything? And they don't either. So there's something quite different. There's something quite categorically changing around about 2 or 3 years of age. And I happen to think this is the point where the child starts to see themselves as independent of the world, as seeing themselves as beginning to get an idea of their self-concept. They start to ask about, am I a boy or am I a girl? Who's this person? They're starting to see themselves in relation to other children. So I think that developing identity produces a framework in which you can then start to hang the information. Now, we know there's some truth to that because in studies, for example, comparing children of Western parents with Eastern parents, in the East, they will talk to their children in a way which allows them to structure their day in more meaningful stories. And they have earlier autobiographical memories compared to children in the West. So something about ordering the information into a format which fits a narrative means it's much easier to recall. And again, that is something that we've known in cognitive psychology for decades, that the easier it is to relate information together, the easier it is to kind of produce a coherent story. The sort of islands, they were like episodic memories. They were kind of who I am. And there is evidence to indicate that when you start to lose these sorts of autobiographical memories, your sense of identity becomes compromised. Though there are some psychologists who argue you can have a self independent of the actual memory, a sense of who you are. I still feel, though, that for most of us, if you were to take away these memories or these islands, then your identity would be compromised, as happens in Alzheimer's disease. And we know this, that people lose this cohesion that they have. And I think what we're doing constantly is retelling the story who we are with some sort of idolized notion of who we think we are. You know, most of us think we're smarter than we are, or funnier than we are, or better looking than we are. We have all these biases. And so we reinterpret behaviors and these episodes in our lives to fit with that coherence of who we think we are. Mm. But these are dynamic systems. They're, you know, you can have a very, very robust event you know, a flashbulb memory, as it's sometimes called, where you remember exactly where you heard when Diana was, you know, when you heard the news she was dead, or you remember where you were when you saw the Twin Towers. You've got a very vivid representation. But even those, which feel perfectly veridical, they turn out to be, in many cases, reconstructed. And we know that. People, you know, George Bush famously, you know, talked about seeing the second plane flying into the second tower. He couldn't have possibly have seen it. We know that as a statement of fact. And yet, when you tell a story and you tell it to yourself a number of times, you believe it to the extent you can't tell the difference between fact and fiction anymore.
There must be a difference between exaggeration when you're telling a story and just saying something that blatantly is not true.
Maybe, but if you tell your own lie repeatedly, then maybe you start to believe, because you've told it so many times you've forgotten what actually happened.
Yeah, because you've learnt it.
Yeah, you've learnt it. You've got to get that story down.
Maybe in like police interviews when people have seen like a crime scene or something like that.
Yeah, actually, I used to work for the Major Crimes Unit writing up interviews, and I was told that eyewitness reports are the least accurate, because everyone is convinced that they saw something when they didn't, or what they see, they fit their own narrative. Hmm. And despite what you would think in a court of law, where an eyewitness testimony would be the most crucial thing, generally it's not.
Mm-hmm.
Because especially after months after you saw something, when you go to trial.
Yeah,
the
time. You know, as well.
Yeah, if you're sort of like stressed or like scared at the time.
Then or surprised, can, or if you've seen a crime, yeah.
I mean, it's just a bonkers thing to think about, that, you know, you've seen something, you know it, and in actual fact you don't. Bruce Hood talks an awful lot about the illusion of
real life.
Yeah, listening to this, I feel like nothing ever that I ever think is real.
The stories that we tell ourselves of who we are, that our memories, our sense of self, are all kind of illusory in a way.
Only in the sense that they are not what they seem. What the brain does is it constructs a representation of the external world. Now, that's a really complex thing to do. Just ask any roboticist or anybody who builds computers. It's really tough. The external world is just full of information. So what the brain has evolved to do over the millions of years is to extract the most relevant parts of that information, the ones which are going to be most useful to you, and then fill in the missing information. I make certain assumptions about the likelihood or the statistical likelihood of things recurring. So you notice patterns. We're a pattern-detecting brain system, okay? So we look out for patterns, the ones which are most useful for us, and we just assume continuity the rest of the time. But, of course, a lot of what we're processing is missing, okay? So we're not processing all the external world. You look out now, you're looking at me, and you've got a nice impression of a very detailed, colorful picture. But we know at the physiology level that you're colorblind in the periphery, that actually it's blurred, you've got two black holes which correspond to your, the blind spots in your eyes, yet you're not aware that you're doing it because your brain is wonderfully filling in and giving you this rich interpretation. Now, that's the outside world. But I'd argue the same thing's going on in the inside world. Because inside, you've got all these machinery of processing vision and all the senses and all the auditory systems. And then you've got all the computational systems all working together, all the memory systems. What do I do in this situation? What I've done in the past. And this all feeds out. So you've basically got two parallel worlds. You've got the parallel world of information out there, full of vast complexity. You've got the internal workings of the mind, which is full of parallel systems. And so you need a serial interface. Because otherwise, you know, trying to deal with these things would just be too much. So I think that's that sense of self. It's this kind of coherent conduit between the complexity of the external world and the chaos of the internal world that just kind of gives you this sense of working along.
So in the film, Riley's kind of like head panel leader person is Joy. Who do you think would be yours out of the five in the film?
Oh, yeah, because in the credits, you go into different people's head and a different emotion is in the command chair.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
Good question.
I'd say fear.
Really?
Yeah.
Ooh, wow, fear is driving you.
Without wanting to slam my parents, but growing up, my mum was kind of very much, you know, you've got to get good grades, and if you don't, you'll not get to university. If you don't get to university, you'll never get a thing. And it was always kind of like this intense fear of failure and letting down my parents. And a lot of actions kind of growing up did kind of stem from just a basic fear.
But is that still the case, or do you think it's changed?
I don't know, but I think growing up definitely would have been fear.
Yeah, do you reckon the person in the driving seat does change around as you go up?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so.
I think I have a battle, and I try and make a conscious choice to put Joy in the driving seat, because some people close to me clearly have more negative emotions in the driving seat. And I think I have a natural tendency to dwell on that side of things. And so I make a choice. Like, I think I try and choose to put joy in the driving seat because that's a better thing for me and because I'm kind of better company if I'm not a massive downer.
Yeah.
Are you sure that's not fear, though? Because you want to be like...
Yes.
The fear of not being liked, you know, being socially acceptable. Are you sure fear's not there manipulating joy behind?
So, yeah, from deeply this film runs. But, again, this is one of the things that I got out of it was that, you know, humans are complicated. You can have mixed emotions and your narrative isn't fixed and think there's flux and flow.
Yeah. I think I can relate to you quite a lot. I think, like, now joy is starting to take over. Like, when you realise that life isn't just exams.
Do you find that studying this is quite odd? Does it make you feel weird? Because
it's really annoying. Cause it's, like, happening in my brain. If I could just, like, think about it, then I would know, like, what's going on.
You're using a brain to study a brain, to understand a brain. I'm struggling with this, just thinking about it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I can't think about that, because then I just go a bit mad.
It is just another organ, but it's just incredibly complicated and complex, and also attached to so many different facets of us, including our personality and potentially our soul and ourself, you know, like, whichever way you define that. I've been reading a lot about the stomach and the gut recently in relation to emotions. Mm-hmm. Is that purely receptive to emotions, or I'm assuming the stomach doesn't generate emotions, but it seems like there's physical manifestations.
The gut does link up to the brain. There's a neuron tract that runs up to the brain, so there is a lot of new evidence that actually shows that what we do to our gut actually impacts our mental health. And that's very new research.
Fear is actually shaped like a piece of broccoli.
Oh, I didn't know.
Oh, my God.
He is shaped like a piece of broccoli. And also, around the world, they had different regional variations. Yeah. In Japan, broccoli is not hated as much as green peppers are. So in the Japanese version, Riley is disgusted at green peppers being on her pizza.
When people go on diets and stuff, they'll always end up craving certain things because of the endorphins. So I don't know if is that really related directly to how your brain works?
Or? Well, I think, yeah, and hormones released by things that you eat as well can also influence your, like, the neurological connections.
Yeah, it is still an organ.
Yeah.
It's just, I guess it's a lot easier to pull apart a heart or a kidney and understand it than it is a brain.
In a sense, it's a heart. You can pull it apart and you can see what it's physically doing. But when a brain stops working, it stops working. You can't kind of look at it, cut it, or can you?
Because neurons, the cells in the brain, have an electrical charge. You can actually record the electrical currents running through them. So what I do is I have a stimulation electrode, so I stimulate a portion of neurons, and then I record from the neurons that are connected to that neuron, and then I record an electrical current, which the current then reflects the connection between the two neurons. So essentially I could actually be recording, like, a memory or an emotion, because it's in the hippocampus, which is a part of the brain which is heavily associated with learning and memory. I could be evoking some kind of memory of the rat
in a dead brain.
But right. the brain isn't, it's not dead, it's taken out of the animal and it's sliced up, but I'm able to keep those cells alive by perfusing it with a solution, which is similar to the solution that runs around our brains.
Yeah. I'm thinking about Mary Shelley. Anyone else?
I was thinking about the man with two brains.
Okay. Yeah. me too.
There are some parts of the brain that are heavily conserved across species, like the hippocampus, which is involved in learning and memory. So we are able to make assumptions about the rat that we can then transfer into humans.
So enlarging the brains of sharks so you can take the brain fluid and use it to cure Alzheimer's disease like they do in Deep Blue Sea. Science fact or science fiction?
Science rubbish.
What?
So there's an awful lot of rubbish and myths about science, neuroscience that's in the public domain. Perhaps the most irritating kind of just nonsense that people believe is that we only use 10% of our brain. Do we only use 10% of our brain?
No. Someone would have picked that up by now in imaging studies if we only used 10% of our brain. All parts of our brain are not, like, completely active at once, but it is constantly chattering. Otherwise, if you don't use it, you lose it. We basically respond to external cues. That's how we function. So, for instance, I'm chatting, like talking to you guys. I'm using like parts of my brain that are involved in like conversation and speech. But our brain has to deal with a lot of stuff. Like I can hear the trees outside, but I'm like deciding to suppress that. Because I'm talking to you, I'm like, oh, look, there's a tree out there and a bird in the sky. Like, I'm noticing all this stuff at the same time.
That's where I'm going wrong.
You're just listening to the trees.
When the dog's like, squirrel!
Or our brains aren't excitatory all the time. So we have neurons that are excitable and neurons that are inhibitory as well. So we have a dampening system to suppress other things while we're doing other things. So we're not constantly, you know, like, on edge thinking about all the sensory inputs. And that's also what goes wrong in disease states as well. Like, people with schizophrenia will perhaps be picking up all senses at once, and they'll be like, oh, look, those trees out there are moving and stuff like that, whereas I'm able to, like, have a conversation because I'm able to suppress everything else that's going on around me.
The trees do sound good, though, don't they?
They do, yeah. It's really
essentially, Andrew, I think she's saying you're never going to become Charles Xavier. Control things with your mind.
Yeah, thank you very much indeed to Professor Bruce Hood for the interview. Absolutely fascinating stuff. Thank you very much indeed to Rachel for joining us here in the shed.
Thanks for having me.
And Anders.
Thank you very much. Pleasure.
And Ty, you're stuck coming to every episode now from now on.
You didn't let me out the shed last time. I've been here ever since.
Those of you who don't know, Ty has an excellent film podcast called Cinema Blindspot. It is genuinely a brilliant podcast. I really recommend it. Earlier on today, was also delighted to be joined in the shed by somebody who's just back from China. And, well, here he is. Hello, Ben.
Hello.
Welcome back to the Cosmic Shed.
Thank you very much. It's lovely to be here.
It's very nice to have you here. Yeah. Now, you suggested that we do this film, Inside Out. You sent an email and in it you said, prediction, Andrew will lose his...
stuff.
Yeah. So, you were right, but why did you think that?
Why did I think that you would become emotionally invested and perhaps quite moved by this story of a young girl coming of age, moving through life, dealing with change and loss, with this crazy narrative going on, but all very grounded and beautifully real situation with lovely visuals.
Okay, fair point, well made. Have you done a poem?
Yes, I have. For this episode, Andrew asked me to keep it really simple, so I've just gone for a classic blues stanza style. It didn't quite work out as I expected, and I will mess this up, but I will give it a go. Good morning, this is your homunculus, the friendly projection in your subconscious, and I've got some thoughts to pass on from the rest of us. Who are we? The controllers of what you call your mind. And the last thing we would want is to be cruel or unkind, but we've noticed that with life choices, you appear to be blind. Take the guys you've been dating, they've kind of all been slobs, and you seem incapable of finding satisfactory jobs, but we're here to say that's okay, we're here to say no probs. See, you view yourself as an autonomous individual, full of free will like a true original, but that kind of thinking is just illusional. And another thing, I'm an illusion too. There's really no one sitting here driving you, because your brain is actually just a chemical stew. That's right, every second, 100,000 reactions, endorphin kills your pain, dopamine stops distractions, and all of these sparks control your daily interactions. So who am I? Who are you? How's your mental health? Is your consciousness something picked off the shelf? No, you just simulate a coherent sense of self. And don't even get me started on your hearing or your vision. Turns out they're mostly constructs of your cerebral system, so good luck trying to make a fully rational decision. Are we saying simply forget it and just go with the flow? Well, maybe sometimes, but it's more important that you know that life's a narrative with many writers. So on with the show.
Thanks, Ben. And if you'd like to hear more of The Cosmic Shed, you can find us on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter.
At the Cosmic Shed.
What I need to do is try and get Ben in to the shed for an episode proper. And that's Fudge, who lives next door. Thank you for listening. Goodbye. The Cosmic Shed.
Science fact.
Science fiction.
And everything in between.